Tonight we're in Genesis chapter 19. It says 18 and 19 on the screen. Those two chapters we've really been looking at together, but we're picking up tonight in chapter 19 there at the beginning. Hopefully we'll be able to cover all of that chapter together tonight. Before we begin looking at the text together, let's start with a word of prayer. If you would please bow with me as we go to God. Holy Father, we give you thanks for this evening, for the time that you've granted us to gather here safely and with those who love you and love each other. We're thankful that we can study your word together and come to greater knowledge of you through seeing especially what you have done in the past, seeing both your judgment and your mercy, seeing your power, seeing the determination that you have to save the righteous. We pray that we would be like those who were of faith that have come before us. We pray that we would follow in their godly footsteps and look to you for guidance, look to you ultimately for salvation. We thank you for the time we have to be with each other this evening, and we pray that you would be with all those who are able to join us. Please continue to bless us with health and with strength and with wisdom and courage to do what is right. We thank you for the time and offer our prayer in Jesus Christ's name. Amen. Well, we left off last week just really in that first verse. I guess the last thing we were able to look at together was the identity, so to speak, or the nature of these two men or angels who have arrived in Sodom. While Lot is there, this is shortly after, they're at the end of chapter 18, or the second half of chapter 18, we found Abraham having this, continuing his meeting with these three men as he saw them. At some point it becomes clear to him that one of those men is Jehovah and that the other two men are messengers of Jehovah, whether that means these were prophets, you know, human prophets of some kind. I think more likely actual angels of the spiritual being variety. But those two men or angels, after Abraham successfully interceded on behalf of the city of Sodom by getting the Lord to agree, essentially, if we can find 10 righteous people in the city, then I will spare it. I won't destroy it as I was going to. The two men have made their trip down to Sodom already, and the Lord departed from Abraham, leaving him to return to his place. He is near Hebron, as we'll find out later in chapter 19. And now we're going to follow what's happening on the ground in Sodom as the two angels arrive at the city. So that's where we are in chapter 19 as we pick up there. At first glance, and we'll notice some of these things. Maybe you notice these as you were reading through chapter 19 together. I've alluded several times to just how much of a cohesive unit these two chapters especially are, chapter 18 and then chapter 19. Chapter 18 began with that visit, the Lord and his two angels coming to visit Abraham, and Abraham showing them hospitality, you know, receiving them for a specific purpose and making this big meal for them and all those sorts of things. Chapter 19 begins in kind of the same way, and we'll notice throughout the story some echoes. There's always a little bit of a twist on those echoes. There's always some kind of an element that's changed that shows the difference and kind of some differences in Abraham and Lot and some differences in what ends up happening in these respective visits. But some of the hallmarks are the same. One thing that we do find as a difference, though, I'll go ahead and just mention that. It's on the sheet that I offered for some kind of study and thought questions as well. In chapter 19, verse 1, Lot is sitting in the gate of Sodom when the angels arrive. Abraham received the two men at his tent flap, or the three men at his tent flap. What does that mean that Lot was sitting in the gate of Sodom? For one thing, it's kind of a weird statement to think about from our perspective, at least. It maybe tells us a little bit about those cities. If we think of someone sitting in the door or standing in the door, they're blocking the door, right? The door is just one cut out in a wall where there are doors. So what does that mean that Lot was sitting in the gate of Sodom? That's it. Yeah, Doug? Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's a good word to use for it. It's the hub of the town, as Brother Wilbert said. It's where a lot of times business is done. You mentioned leaders. It's a lot of time where decisions would be made, judgments might be rendered. If you look at the book of Ruth, for instance, we get another kind of picture of daily Jewish social life, and there you have a lot of business dealings and legal dealings kind of that are settled there in the gates of the city. That gate complex is kind of almost a courtyard type setup that's built right at the opening into the city. And it's all considered part of the gate. And so that's where the prominent men of the city, the judges, those types of folks would commonly be found. And a lot of gossip is going to be exchanged in that area. A lot of folks are going to be running into each other, kind of settling disputes, all the things that we've just mentioned. So Lot's sitting in the gate of Sodom. I mentioned that it might serve two purposes. What does it mean practically? One is just that, the location. Is there anything about that information that is significant, that Lot's sitting in the gate of Sodom?
Drew.
Yeah.
It's almost as if that was kind of his way of protecting a foreigner that came in that maybe was unbeknownst to the way that Sodom was, and just being the semi-righteous man that he was, if you will, wanted to be sure that he could catch that person and kind of take him under his wing safely before they realized what was going to happen. That's at least kind of how I've seen it in part.
Okay. Dylan brings up a good consideration there, and I think we're definitely going to see some of that in verse 2, the way he responds to them. If you couldn't hear him, he mentions maybe kind of playing an intercepting role of being able to see a visitor coming in and maybe shield them, shelter them a little bit from the kinds of things that might typically go on in Sodom. And he certainly is able to play that role to an extent with these two visitors. Brother Farron? Okay, I think that's one of the kind of thematic notes that we're getting here. When all this saga first started, all the way back in chapter 13, it's Abram and Lot. We're getting too wealthy, essentially. Our herds are getting too big. You pick which way you're going to go, and I'll go the other way. Lot chooses Sodom. We got the notes there in chapter 13 that were telling us, the people of Sodom are wicked. This could end up spelling trouble for Lot. And even there in chapter 13, we were told he pitched his tent as far as Sodom. He's still outside the city, but he's not just dwelling in the plains in that area where his herds can graze and everything. He's going as far as the city. Now, when we're reintroduced to him, you know, after the kidnapping saga and all that has gone on as well, but now when we meet him again, he's in the city, in the gate, in a prominent position in the city. He's not just a guy who has kind of been hiding out somewhere and, well, you know, I had to make do or whatever. He's clearly quite comfortable there. He's in position. He's been embedded in Sodom's culture, in their city, is really kind of the note that we're getting there. What this might also imply, if we compare this or maybe put it in conjunction with what we read in verse 9, what do the men of the city end up saying about Lot? What had he been styling himself as, according to them? Yeah, acting like a judge among us. And they resent that, apparently, because he is a foreigner. He's a resident alien among them. And, you know, you're trying to come here and tell us what to do. Again, I mean, this is just giving us the information about how comfortable Lot is there. He's not just somebody who happens to live in Sodom. He's become a part of the fabric of the city. If we're putting the good spin on that for Lot's sake, we will find, all right, he is described by the scriptures as a righteous man. Maybe he's trying to wield his influence effectively and is trying to, you know, correct some of the wrongs that he sees going on around him all the time. We're told his soul is tormented by what he sees going on. Maybe it's that idea of, I can only change it from the inside. What chapter 19 is going to end up revealing is, if that was his plan, it didn't work very well. For himself, for the city, for his family, that plan backfired on him, if that was his intention. But Lot's getting comfortable. The other idea with that, I mentioned there in verses 1 through 3, first of all, saying, you know, as he sees these two men, and as was the case with Abram, I don't know if he knew from the beginning that these weren't just men, that they weren't just guys. And Dylan kind of spoke to this a moment ago. As far as I can tell at this point in the story, it's just Lot who sees two strangers. And we mentioned last week the idea that Hebrews brings up of men entertaining angels without knowing who they were, and I think that's a reference to these two chapters that would kind of support that as well. He's just providing hospitality to strangers. But he tells them, you know, come in and turn in here, stay the night, wash your feet, you know, enjoy some rest, and then you can get up early and go on your way. And they say, no, we'll spend the night in the open square. And then in verse 3 he says, no. He insists strongly. So he's finally able to prevail upon them, and he gives them this meal. What might have motivated that insistence when they tried to say, no, we're fine, we'll be okay? Why does Lot keep pushing? Okay. All right. Yeah, some idea of what could happen, at least. I think this is another indication of just the well-known character of the inhabitants of Sodom, just how common the knowledge was that this is a wicked place. And once again, we're getting the idea that it's based on evidence. It's based on eyewitness testimony. As we saw last week with the Lord telling Abraham, really kind of for his benefit, I'm going to go down and investigate. I'm going to go down and look. And then I'll see what's going on. Well, here we've got a man who is such a part of the city that he's sitting in the gates as business is going on, and even he knows. I mean, this isn't just propaganda against Sodom or the rumors that go around in other cities that people have heard about them. This is a guy who knows very well, no, you don't want to be outdoors at night, not here. So why don't you come in and stay with me? All throughout, it does seem that he has that fear from the beginning. Even in some of the things that he says, there in verse 2, you can wash your feet and then rise early and go on your way. In other words, you know, you don't want to spend more time here than you need to. He serves unleavened bread, which is a meal that can be prepared quickly. It's not the huge spread that Abraham lays out in chapter 18, for instance. It's just kind of the basics, something that you can get to quickly. The idea, the image that we're getting all throughout this is just, let me get you guys a meal, a place to stay, and then you get up as early as you can tomorrow and be on your way and put this place behind you is kind of the image that we're getting from all of this. Well, any other questions there up to about verse 3 before we continue? Yeah, Doug. Sure. Yeah, that is interesting, and kind of along the lines of what we were wondering a minute ago, you know, did they know who they were? What did they perceive about them? And you're right, it is the same thing said of Abram as here in chapter 19, verse 1. The response is them bowing themselves to the ground. I don't know enough about you know, would that have been a common way of just showing respect or greeting? That kind of seems unlikely for just a visitor, a passerby, that you would kind of humble yourself that much in showing that degree of respect to them. So maybe there was some kind of perception that they had about who these men were or where they came from. Maybe, you know, we're not told everything that passes in this conversation. Maybe they say who they're with, sort of, or what reason they've come here for, that they're from Jehovah and they're looking at the city. I don't know, but it does, that verse 1, as Brother Wilburn rightly points out, might indicate some kind of knowledge on Lot's part of who these men are or where they've come from. Good point. Well, those fears that Lot had, if he was worried, they proved to be true, and we won't spend a lot of time rehearsing, you know, everything that ends up happening here. It is fairly well known. It's an infamous account, but one question that I asked was from verse 4 there, who is it that the scriptures mention is the aggressor in this account? Look kind of carefully at how they're described. Who actually ends up coming out to the house? All right, the men of the city, and there is there's a repetition of the word men or man several times, I think like four times between verses 4 and 5. It talks a lot about the men of the city, the men of Sodom. Where are the men who have come in here? There's kind of a pointed repetition of that idea of the men doing something. It's the men of Sodom. Well, which kind? Probably just the rabble, right? Probably just, you know, like every place has a few bad elements. If you go to the wrong part of town, you might get the wrong crowd, but it doesn't really reflect the character of the city, right? So this is just the bad guys in Sodom. Okay, young and old, all the men of the city, from every quarter, all the people from every quarter, both old and young, and again, saying that twice there, the men of the city, the men of Sodom, this is an inclusive group. This is a representative group of the men of Sodom. This is not just the bad element. It's not just the folks you have to watch out for. It's kind of, as I've titled this section, an ordinary evening in Sodom. This is what the people are like, apparently. And we don't get the call, we don't get the idea that there were other folks in Sodom who were kind of trying to call them off and calm them down and say, you know, this isn't how we treat passersby here. This isn't the kind of thing we do. You just get the image of a lot of folks, young and old, from every quarter coming together to do this. We're continuing to see just more and more mounting evidence of the pervasive wickedness of the city. So they gather around. They are intent on sexual violence against the two men who have come. They want them to be brought out so that they can know them carnally, verse 5 says. Thankfully, this account is pretty scant on details. I mentioned there in verse 9 what we talked about a moment ago, maybe also some kind of antipathy towards foreigners there, that they didn't like someone coming in from outside and telling them what to do. One of the really incredible parts of this passage is what ends up happening in verse 8. Lot, seeing what they are intending to do to his guests, to these two visitors, whoever they might be in his eyes, he instead says in verse 8, don't do that, don't do so wickedly, but I have two daughters who have not known a man. I'll bring them out to you, and you may do as you wish to them. Just not the men who have come under the shadow of my roof. I will just open it up for thoughts, reasoning on this. I mentioned there on the question sheet, Lot described in 2 Peter 2 a righteous man. What can be said about this decision? How do we make sense of this or explain this? Yeah, Tim? Yeah. To me, at least, it'd be impossible to say or difficult to say. I don't know. I guess if we talked earlier, I guess when we were looking at chapter 14, Abraham was able to go with 318 men and kind of defeat the army, or at least part of the army, of those who had taken Lot and some of the captives away, which is not a very big force. And, you know, there's not an indication of that being like a miraculous victory type thing. So this probably is not like a booming metropolis. But dozens of men, I don't know. That's all. That's me thinking just more how it feels, I guess, than what I know. Anyone else has any insight into that, go for it. But I don't know. From the description, again, just getting back to verse 4, all the people from every quarter, young and old, I mean, it is giving you the impression of a sizable group. That's, you wouldn't describe six guys that way, would you? I mean, this is clearly quite a few people, but it's not, you know, all of the men in Tulsa getting together to do this. Good question. Wish I could answer it better. Derek? Yeah. Right. Good, a very good summary of what we're seeing here, with this as kind of the capstone to what began in chapter 13. You can't put yourself in that situation and not expect there to be consequences. You can't avoid that influence. You can't avoid what will happen as a result of that. And this does tie all the way back to chapter 13. There are a lot of callbacks to it. There are a lot of reminders of how all this began. Think about, and this has a lot of practical consequences for us when we think about something that may not seem like that big of a decision. I mean, where you live is a pretty big decision, but there are many things that every day we think of are probably not going to matter that much, you know, spiritually. It's not going to determine my, you know, my eternal fate. It's not going to determine the huge things that happen in my life. Lot is just picking a place to live. I mean, it's east or west, and he chooses one. Look at everything. By the end of this chapter, we'll really see this, and we'll remind ourselves again. Look at everything that will end up happening to him. Not all just the fault of that. I mean, there are other things that come into play in that as well. But if he hadn't made that decision, and based on that logic that he employed there, which is just, it looks good, how many of these things wouldn't have happened? I mean, this is the result of that choice. And I think seeing him, what he's willing to do, the kind of the effect that living here has had on his morality seems to be what is happening, that this has eroded something in him that makes him think this is a good idea, that this is an acceptable offer or trade to make. You've been in Sodom too long, man. You've gotten too comfortable here. This place has done a number on you. It's saying to me when we see Lot doing something really so unthinkable. Other comments there, other ideas along those lines. Yeah, Doug. And then... Yeah. 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 Sure. And that's a good reminder to have. In many cases where we talk about the failings of these men, like Abraham, you know, lying about who Sarah was, or we looked at several lessons from Hebrews chapter 11 a few weeks ago, maybe a couple months ago by now, and mentioned, yeah, you can find skeletons in all those closets. I mean, the way Noah's life ends with some, you know, bouts of drunkenness and everything that happens with his sons as a result of that. David committing murder, essentially, and committing adultery. You know, all these different men that you have that have some big glaring sign of, man, what were you thinking? How could you have done that? How could this be a righteous man? That's not what faith is about. That's not what righteousness is about, is meaning perfection, that you don't ever do something so boneheaded or so evil in hindsight that you think, how could you possibly have done that? Even if we're looking at this as Lot's lowest moment, which it might very well have been up to this point in his life, we can still call him a righteous man. And Doug mentions maybe the having a good intention here, and it seems that he does, at least in his mind, this is to him the right thing to do. We often mention how much of a premium people placed on hospitality in these days, and to allow something to happen to someone who had come under your roof for shelter would just be the height of, you know, dishonor. Again, though, I keep coming back to, your daughters live under your roof all the time, though. What do you want to happen to them? So it is difficult for me. I'll let Dylan go.
No, you're good. I think all the points that have been made are fantastic. I think to Doug's point, it just, you take the subjectivity out of it. Objectively, even the righteous make mistakes.
Yeah.
And it reminds me a lot of Romans 1, though, what had happened to Lot, in that he had chosen the path of the world. He'd chosen the path of wealth and glory and whatever it is he wanted. And in that moment, even being righteous, because if we remember, Abraham basically pleads with God, look, if there's only X amount of people, will you please not destroy the city? And a good lesson to us in what the angels do to them, that sin had blinded the city so bad that even in their blind lust, there was not a righteous person there. And yep. Even considering Lot would be said as righteous, which we know that comes up later on in the New Testament as well,
right?
It would be that we still make poor choices. And maybe a good lesson or an example, as the New Testament tells us, the Old Testament is there for us, it would be that even a righteous person can make mistakes and make poor choices, but if we consistently choose the world over God, we shouldn't be surprised by our poor actions.
Yeah, that's going to be, when that's the input, here is an expected output. Here's an expected result from it. Yeah. Yeah, all along this account, again, going all the way back to chapter 13, kind of every step we've seen from Lot up to this point, including during the destruction of the city, after the destruction of the city, there's a lot of bad decisions being made. Brother Farron mentions one, that, you know, where are we going to go afterward? I want to go to the mountains. No, I want to go to the city. No, I'm, you know, this flip-flopping back and forth. He's not in a good way here during any of this. What that says about his righteousness, or what it means to be righteous, would be kind of a useful discussion as far as what the limits of that are, or what the real meaning of that is. But for Lot right now, even assuming the best of him, he's got some problems that he's going through here. The primary or kind of the, as far as practical things we can take away from up to this point, this can be one of the effects of living here. Derek mentioned several ideas earlier, and we'll see these as we continue on, but you know, be looking at them as you go along and just see how many things end up going wrong for this family because of what feels like too much influence from this place, too much attachment to Sodom and to life there. It's not just Lot who's wrestling with it. We'll see a few more here in a few minutes, if we get that tonight. All right, well, beginning in verse 12, oh, and I kind of skipped over, of course, what happens. Beginning in verse 10, it's only the action of the angels that are able to cool things off and get Lot and his family, at least, out of the predicament they were in. They pull him back inside. All the men were struck with blindness. That seems to be not just that they lost their vision, but kind of some idea of being stunned, sort of. It's very similar in feel to what happens with Paul as he's going on the road to Damascus, not just losing his sight, but having some kind of an experience that left him kind of befuddled a little bit. You know, he heard a voice, didn't know who, kind of didn't understand what was going on fully right then. All the men around him thought they heard something, but weren't really sure what they heard. They're striking them with blindness. I think that is literal, that they could not see for a while, but I think there's also some confusion as well that's going on. They're unable to get into them for a while. So the angels tell everyone, tell Lot, it's time to go. In verse 12, language begins to get very urgent, and it's easy to see why based on what's going on. Take them out of this place. We're going to destroy this place. Beginning in verse 12, the account starts to really take on close similarity to the story of the flood. As God set up the anticipation for in that instance, I'm not going to destroy the earth with water again. Next time it'll be fire. Here's the down payment on that idea. It's going to literally rain fire on Sodom and Gomorrah and the cities of the plains. But the similarities in broad strokes, you have this pervasive evil. In the flood generation, remember, it was the intention, the thoughts of men's hearts were only evil continually. I mean, they just couldn't have a thought without it being something wicked. Here in Sodom, you know, everyone in the city turns out to perform deviancy on strangers. So you have this perpetual, pervasive evil, so much so that it is too much for the Lord to bear. Remember back in chapter 18, God saying, the outcry has risen up against me, the wickedness that I have heard of, and that's what is mentioned again in verse 13. The outcry against them has grown great before the face of the Lord. He simply can't tolerate it anymore. So he visits the earth with destruction, and only a few are going to be spared. In Noah's case, it was him and his wife and his three sons and their wives. Here it will be Lot and eventually only his two daughters. But just taking note of a few themes, and we'll go through these kind of quickly. We've touched on a few of them already. Look at one idea that we see here, which is the ability or the lack of ability to take God seriously. This is also something that we found in chapter 18. That same verb, and in chapter 17 as well, even going back to Abraham's laughter, that Isaac word, that laughter, that we're really anticipating by chapter 21. But when Abraham heard God say, "You're going to have a son," still I mean that, your physical flesh, you will have a son, he laughed in kind of disbelief. When Sarah hears, "You're going to have a son with Abram here this time next year," she laughs and says, sure, really, I'm going to have a child, I'm almost, I'm 90 years old. When Lot goes to his sons-in-law, they laugh, again, in that kind of disbelief. I love what Robert Alter writes about that. It is, of course, a wry echo. The laughter of disbelief of those about to be divinely blessed, that's Abraham and Sarah, versus the false perception of mocking laughter by those about to be destroyed. One of these is a lot more serious and a lot more dangerous than the other. We mentioned Abraham and Sarah laughing kind of, I don't want to say in a good way, but I mean it's kind of an understandable thing that God is going to bless you with such a great thing that you simply have trouble believing it and have to kind of laugh. And that turns into, ultimately, for Sarah, the joyful laughter of that son being born, Isaac. Being born in chapter 21, and she's able to say then again, "I'm laughing and everyone else is laughing with me," out of our joy over what has happened. This is not a laughter of, oh, God is so wonderful, I can't even believe that this would happen to me. This is, oh, sure, we're in trouble, there's danger coming, oh, judgment is going to happen, God's unhappy with what we've been doing. Yeah, right. I mean, they just don't take that seriously at all. That's a really dangerous kind of disbelieving laughter to have. When God speaks of his judgment and mentions his plan for judgment, don't laugh. Don't laugh at that. Don't mock that. And that's what we see the sons-in-law doing, unfortunately. A second idea, the mercy of God. Lot is saved, and Brother Colson mentioned this a moment ago, too. Pay attention to kind of what's necessary to get Lot out of there. And I mentioned quite literally, it is only the hand of God, I guess we'd say the hand of his angels, that is literally going to have to pull Lot out of this. In verse 10, they first snatch him out of the door, but then by verse 16, when he's trying, I mean, he's going to his sons-in-law, telling them to get ready, which the angels had told him to do. He's trying to get everyone rounded up. But then by verse 16, we find that he's lingering. And the angels had already told him in verse 15 that they're urging him to hurry, saying, get your wife and any family that you can gather, anyone that you care about, and get out of here. For some reason, Lot is still lingering. He's taking his time. This is hard to imagine, isn't it? If you're told the city is going to be destroyed by God within minutes, within hours, get out of here and head to the mountains. You're going to see a Drew-shaped hole in those windows back there. I'm out of here. I'm getting out of the city. I'm going to get anything I can, anyone that I can, and we're heading for the hills. Lot is taking his time. He's kind of, well, do we have this? Who else are we going to talk to? Oh, get the lamp and do all that. Lot, get out of there. So they have to, once again, take hold of his hand and his wife's hand and the hands of his two daughters. Physically, get out. It's time to go. So he is saved only through that insistence by God. This is typically an incident that is famous as an example of God's judgment, right? When people mention Sodom and Gomorrah, you picture fire and brimstone. You picture destruction. You picture God is angry at wickedness and he's going to destroy it. He's going to turn that place into charred rubble on the ground where there once was a city. But really one of the big images throughout this is that he does save people. He does have mercy on people who are not really acting like they are worth being saved at this point, like they really understand that they need to be saved still, but God still shows his mercy and his kindness towards them in saving them. All of that in addition, of course, to what we saw at the end of chapter 18 with Abraham trying to say, if you can find 50 righteous will save the city, and the Lord said yes all the way down to 10 men, allowing Abraham to make things as easy as possible for the city to be saved, and they still simply couldn't live up to that. So his patience but urgency still in saying you need to get out of this. I want you to be saved from this. Another idea that we've looked at a couple of times already, the entire chapter really showing an unseemly attachment to life in Sodom. From Lot all the way down to really kind of every other member of the family. They do have to be literally pulled out and urged and told to hurry on, quit lingering, get out. Lot, the decisions that he makes, I think, are showing some of that kind of moral erosion. What he offers to do with his daughters, what he will end up doing with his daughters, what they will end up doing to him, beginning in verse 30 after all this happens. He begs his rescuers, he begs the angels, let me have a city that I can go to. I mean, again, it's kind of difficult for us to imagine. You're being told to leave and to go somewhere else because this place is going to be destroyed. And you say, well, I don't want to go there. Let me go over here. No, it doesn't matter. Get out. Go where you're told and get out and be safe. And then, of course, his wife in verse 26 looks back and seems that isn't just meaning literally she looked over her shoulder when she wasn't supposed to. In her heart, she is looking back. She is not ready to part with everything that Sodom represents. So the influence here, the attachment that they have developed to the place, ends up really being a thorn in their side. So after this focus on Lot's family for so long, beginning in verse 27, we find Abraham. The story shifts back to him, kind of the widescreen view. It pans back and shows us everything that's going on. And here is Abraham early in the morning in verse 27, going back to where he had stood before the Lord, where they had had that conversation. And despite his pleas, despite his kind of bargaining conversation with the Lord to get the number of the righteous needed down to 10, despite his best efforts and all of his hopes that the city can be spared, imagine what Abraham is thinking maybe as he looks out in that direction, in the direction of Sodom, and sees smoke rising. He sees like the smoke coming out of an oven or a furnace. Kind of an eerie picture that we get there of him seeing the result, the evidence of the devastation, even from... But who's responsible ultimately in verse 29? Well, God above all, but why is Lot saved? Okay. That's an interesting statement, isn't it? God remembered Abraham. Not that God remembered Lot, although, as we've said, and I'm not denying it or disputing it, Lot is a righteous man himself. But the specific reason given, why does God still save him? Why does he get him out? Because he remembered Abraham, because of his knowledge of or his respect for Abraham, his friend, the man he's entered into covenant with, the one that he has promised, I'll bless those who bless you, and I will curse those who curse you. I am with you. I will be with you in the world. Because Lot is known to Abraham, he ends up being spared. He sent Lot out of the midst of the overthrow when he did that, because he remembered and knew Abraham. That is another kind of link back to chapter 14. Yet again, Abraham has saved Lot's skin only because of his goodness, only because of his righteousness before God. Ron? Yeah. Yeah, it is interesting, and that's a good segue into, and I'm sorry that I'm flying through this last part. A good segue into what we find beginning in verse 30, though, which is this epilogue. And as Ron points out, this is the end of Lot as far as the Old Testament is concerned. This is the last of his story, which is, I mean, it's a terrible way for his story to end. I don't know what became of him after this. I hope he was able to pick the pieces up and do something better. I just don't know. But we alluded to earlier that kind of conversation that they had back there in verse 18 or so, where they tell him, get up here and go to the mountains. And he said, no, I want to go to this city. It's a small city, Zoar. I mean, you don't need to destroy it. It's not a big place. Maybe the people there aren't that bad. You can leave it alone. And they say, okay, whatever. I mean, go ahead, go there. After they agree to that, though, after he had that thrown into the contract, they decide to leave in verse 30. They don't want to stay in the city anymore. They go back to the mountains. And he takes his two daughters with him. They were afraid to dwell in Zoar. I don't know if this is... You know, is he having flashbacks to what happens or what can happen in a city? He's not comfortable there anymore. It mentions his fear. They were afraid maybe that God would do that kind of thing again. Maybe they encountered wicked people there, and he's thinking, you know, I don't want to be caught in the middle of this again. Maybe two angels won't show up at the right time now. I don't know what the fear is, but it's this strange kind of flip-flopping back and forth. The way Derek Kidner describes it, I think, is pretty accurate there. It's all based on his fear, which is not really a godly fear. It's just kind of this paralyzing fear that causes him to live in this topsy-turvy turmoil. Fear had brushed aside the call and now the pledge of God. Go to the mountains, you'll be safe. And he says, no, I'm afraid to do that. I want to go to a city. He goes to the city where they had said, okay, you'll be safe there. And he says, I'm afraid to do that. I've got to go to the mountains. It's damaging his ability to trust God and what he has said he would do for him. Again, think broad terms what has happened with Lot as a result of the decision made back in chapter 13. When all of that started, they had to separate because they were so insanely wealthy and were profiting so much, had these herds that were becoming so big, they literally didn't have any room for their animals and their men to coexist together anymore. Now, in chapter 19, it's a guy with his two daughters living in a cave in the mountains. That's a pretty big change. That's a pretty big fall from grace. Quickly, the irony that we find, and I won't take a lot of time going through the details here. In short form, his daughters fearing, here's kind of another echo of the flood. It seems like the whole world has been destroyed to them. It's only their family that is left in their eyes. So they decide we're going to get our father drunk. They end up having incestuous relations with him and end up providing children who become the nations of Moab and Ammon as a result of that, and kind of fulfilled that threatening potential later on in their histories. But kind of a sense of irony or almost a poetic justice in what's going on. These two daughters that he was trying to throw out to an angry mob of violent deviants, they end up having children through him. They end up getting him drunk and seducing him. And he is oblivious to the whole affair. That's, I think, maybe the most pointed callback. Remember what the men wanted to do in verse 5. They wanted to know them, which is a euphemism you find a lot of times in the scriptures. We want to know them. Both times when his daughters come to Lot and do what they're going to do, it says that he did not know when she did that. And it's the same word. It's obviously just used in a different sense. So in the first time, it's a euphemism for the carnality. In this sense, it's saying, but literally, he didn't know what was going on to point out his cluelessness in the whole. But that's the mark left by life in Sodom, is this kind of precipitous fall. And that's where we close the book on Lot. Comments, questions along those lines before we finish? All right, I apologize. I did take a few extra minutes tonight, but I wanted to go ahead and finish that so that we can start fresh on chapter 20, getting back to Abraham, getting back to his story. Read the next two chapters, if you would, for next week, 20 and 21. I don't know if we'll get to 21, but be prepared for it, if you would. Thank you all very much for your attention tonight.